Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Utterly Moderate is the official podcast of the Connors Forum. Visit us at connorsforum.org and be sure to subscribe to our free email newsletter while you are there.
Please listen carefully.
Carefully. Carefully.
Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Utterly Moderate Podcast. I'm your host, Lawrence Eppard. Thanks for stopping in for another episode. Certainly appreciate you being here as we tackle the big issues facing American society today. Before we dive into today's episode, though, I had a quick thought that I wanted to share with you. You know, on this podcast, we talk about a lot of really controversial and polarizing and sometimes depressing topics, and it can be pretty easy to lose track of just how good things are at this moment. And I know that's a really weird thing to say. There's so much noise, so many people yelling in our society, so much division, so many negative headlines. But if you unplug from all that, you know, unplug from the culture wars and the social media scrums and just take a step back, if you really, really think about it, in so many ways, life is as good now in America as it's ever been. I know that's a weird thing to say, but, you know, think about it. I mean, you know, think of five things that you think are important for a country to do well. You know, if you wanted to live in that country, these are five things they should do well. You know, I mean, whatever it is you think is important, like they should have a long life expectancy, or women should have an equal place in society, or there should be a high level of income and wealth. I mean, whatever it is you think is important. And look back throughout the history of our society and think, like, is there really any other time you would want to live in but now? Or look around the world. How many other countries are there across those measures that you would want to live in besides the US? There are others, of course. I'm not saying there aren't. There are many great countries to live in, but this is one of the good ones. And certainly this is one of the good times to live in American society. And again, there's so much division, so much noise, so many negative headlines. It can be easy to lose track of that. And, you know, I had this thought because last night I was tucking in my daughter and my toddler into bed. And I have five kids. And my household's amazing. I got seven people in my household, my wife and I, and my five kids and my dog and our cats. And it's a pretty wonderful place to wake up every morning and to spend time in. And I was tucking my kids in and, you know, I was thinking about my own childhood and kind of how lost you can feel growing up. Like, what's the future going to hold? You know, what kind of job should I strive for? Will I be happy? Will I have a family? Will I be successful? I mean, you know, what's the meaning of it all? You know, when you're growing up, it can seem so bewildering. And I remember having that feeling for so much of my life. You know, what's the point of all this? Until I had a family. And, you know, each of the five times that I've watched my children being born, those are the five greatest moments of my life. It's truly amazing to spend, you know, to find out that your wife is pregnant and then spend 9 months, you know, thinking, what's this kid going to look like? You know, is it going to be a boy or a girl? And then going from one moment, there's no human being here, to the next moment, all of a sudden a baby emerges and you get to see what they look like for the first time. And, you just feel this incredible, incredible outpouring of love and joy. And, you know, I didn't even want kids when I was younger. And I just, you know, I was thinking about this last night, and I was thinking, you know, how bewildering youth can be. And, you know, like I said, what's the meaning of it all? And once I had kids, once I had my first child, I realized this is it. This is the meaning of it all. My family. And just pouring love on them and spending time with them. And, you know, when I take a step back from all the nastiness and all the awfulness, I realize, you know, this is a pretty good time to be alive. And all you got to do is look around you. There's a movie that I really, really love by Christopher Nolan called Interstellar. And there's a quote in there. One of the main characters, Matthew McConaughey's character, he's talking to his daughter. And he's got this great quote, and I'll probably butcher it, but he's got this great quote that he says to her. He says, you know, he's talking about being parents. And he says, "We're just here to be memories for our kids. Once you're a parent, you're the ghost of your children's future." And I just, that quote means so much to me, and it really kind of floored me when I heard it. And I just always keep that in the back of my mind that, you know, I'm here to pour love on my kids, spend time with them, and, you know, to give them great memories of me and of our family, and give them just a great foundation to springboard them into their futures. And I don't know, you know, I mean, you know, today's episode, we're going to talk about some tough topics and, you know, some problems facing our country. But, you know, take a step back from it all. Take a look around you. Take a look at the things that you love, and things are going to be okay. Things are pretty good. Well, on today's episode, we are going to be talking about the very questionable science behind microaggressions. If you're unfamiliar with this term, microaggressions are claimed to be acts that on the surface can look harmless but convey subtle animus or bias against someone in a traditionally marginalized group. Now, let me be very clear. The point of today's episode is not to dismiss the concept of microaggressions or to claim they are not real. I firmly believe they are real and they are damaging. That is not the point of today's episode. The point of today's episode is really to kind of shine a light on what many researchers are doing in this area. They're making a lot of claims that go far beyond what the actual data says. So, you know, the research is really in its infancy, and many researchers are making claims that they just haven't provided solid evidence for yet. You know, I mean, imagine if, you know, your friend had cancer and they ate a certain kind of fruit or took some experimental medicine or whatever, and all of a sudden they were feeling better and all of a sudden the cancer was gone. You wouldn't then rush out on TV and say, "We've got the cure for cancer. Everybody take it immediately." That's kind of what I see microaggressions researchers doing. We are at the very early stages of figuring out what this thing is, how we define it, how we know it's happened, you know, what the damage is that they cause. But many researchers have just gone miles ahead of where the research actually is and claim things that just don't have strong support yet. So that's the point of this episode, not to dismiss microaggressions. I believe they're real. I believe they're very real. But to just shine a light on the research itself and how questionable a lot of it is at this moment. Okay, so again, microaggressions. These are acts that on the surface can look harmless but convey subtle animus or bias against someone in a traditionally marginalized group, right? So, you know, if you're on an elevator and a white person gets on and you kind of smile and, you know, nod your head, and then an African-American gets on the elevator and you clutch your purse, you know, that would be considered a microaggression, right? Like, it conveys something about how you feel about that group. When the person picks up on it, it can be stressful and can convey sort of, you know, negative judgments of them and make them feel bad. That's a microaggression, right? And it's subtle. There's some plausible deniability, right? It's like, well, I wasn't, you know, saying anything racist, or I wasn't doing anything racist. That's what a microaggression is. And in their review of the research on microaggressions, Edward Cantu and Lee Jussum, like many other scholars who have examined this research closely, they argue that, quote, after reviewing scholarship in which psychologists attempt to confirm the legitimacy of the prevailing microaggression perspective, and in which they debate the issue with dissenting psychologists, we conclude that the current operationalization of microaggressions in social justice discourse, legal scholarship, and education administration is significantly unwarranted, end quote. They go on to say that based on their analysis, quote, researchers' claims about microaggressions are without adequate scientific basis, end quote. And they say that research on microaggressions is mixed, unsettled, and, quote, in its infancy, and is most definitely not ready for applications in the real world, end quote. Of the many problems that they find with microaggression research, they note that, for one thing, researchers state that several acts are microaggressions simply by claiming them to be so, without proper scientific basis. They say there's no scientifically rigorous method for identifying whether many microaggressions have or have not occurred. They say proof that a microaggression has occurred often largely depends upon the subjective experience of the victim, leaving the researcher no way to verify that it took place and no way to verify the intent of the perpetrator. They note that microaggression researchers argue that microaggressions cause harm, but in many instances, they haven't empirically demonstrated that harm. They note that there's no evidence that most racial minorities consistently consider several claimed microaggressions to actually be offensive. They note there's no demonstrated link between many microaggressions and racial bias on the part of the perpetrator. They argue that many supposed microaggressions have multiple interpretations, but they're determined to be microaggressions by researchers because the researchers themselves privilege a particular interpretation. And they say that some researchers claim that microaggressions occur with a frequency that they have not empirically demonstrated. And you can go read their work on this. There are many other problems they find with the microaggression research, and I'll link to their work in the show notes. So joining us to discuss this is the co-author of this study that I just mentioned, Rutgers University Distinguished Professor of Psychology Lee Jussum. And we'll dive into the questionable science of microaggressions with Lee coming up next. So Lee Jussum, welcome to the Utterly Moderate Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So Lee, I bring you on the show today because I am increasingly concerned with ideology parading as scholarship. And I had Jacob Mackey from Occidental College on recently, and he talked about virtuous lies. He says that, you know, increasingly the social sciences, if a claim fits with our ideological worldview, it goes unchallenged. And you have a quote here, and I got to read this to the audience because I think it captures what I'm talking about, and it's actually a gut punch to me as a social scientist. So it says, quote, and this is from our guest Lee. He says, quote, peer-reviewed social science creates myths about the power of problems that has not actually established to exist to any substantial degree. End quote. Lee, That's a problem. So tell me, unpack that for us. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, the peer-reviewed, so I'm not talking about the natural, for the most part, I'm not talking about natural sciences. You know, if articles in the peer-reviewed literature are addressing the atmosphere on exoplanets or how to build ceramics of greater tensile strength, these issues don't come up. You know, there's no politicalization of these issues. And so there's not, there may be errors and science is imperfect, but you don't get the same sort of distortions that you get in politicized social science where people really want to, you know, they want to change the world. And often they think they're going to do that by exposing just how evil the world really is. So that seems to me to be the start. So you have all this social science around things like microaggressions and implicit biases, on the supposed inaccuracy of stereotypes, on the power of self-fulfilling prophecies, on the power of stereotype threat. And so you just have this, you know, what is it? It's this like cycle of interest and commitment to grinding a particular axe or variations on a particular axe. And so, you know, this million, exactly as you described in the intro, people within the social sciences want to believe certain things. You know, the social sciences skew really substantially left. Like, not only is the skew left, Nate Honeycutt, my most recent PhD, now works for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. His PhD, which was conducted in 2022, was a survey of almost 2,000 professors at, you know, the top tier, not just the top two or three tiers of research-oriented colleges and universities. So these are not primarily teaching universities. These are either primarily research universities or these sort of blended teaching research universities. And what he found were that 40% self-described as radicals, activists, Marxists, or socialists.
Wow.
40%. Right. So these, you know, I mean, you could, it's possible to be a Marxist and to do unbiased research, but what you have, even though that's possible, you have a lot of people really wanting to believe a lot of things that sort of vindicate left and even far left worldviews. And so that's what gets into the peer-reviewed literature.
Do you get a sense that social science has become more so this in recent years, or do you think this has always been the case and we're just paying more attention to it now?
It's probably a little bit of both, but I think it's definitely gotten worse the last 10 years or so. So it had been getting worse for a while because the skew is becoming more extreme. So, you know, if you go back far enough, if you go back 100 years, the best evidence we have is that it was about 50-50, might have even leaned right a little bit. If you go back to the 50s and 60s, you know, it was leaned left, but it was like 60-40, 65-35. And as long as you had, as long as there were 30-35% faculty who were not left, that was enough to provide skeptical checks.
All right. So I believe where you left off, you were talking about the imbalance in liberal to conservative faculty.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not just liberal to conservative. It's that at this point, and I think the numbers are growing, at least at the, you know, main research producing, knowledge producing institutions in the country, it's approaching a majority, not just left, but far left. Mm-hmm. And that's a very different dynamic than a 60-40 split. You know, I mean, there's basically, you know, if you assume, which won't always be correct, but in general, it's probably true, that if you have some, you know, left affirming finding, let's say in the power and extent of discrimination, of some sort of discrimination, then conservatives might be more highly motivated to skeptically vet that claim than would people on the far left who presume it's true from the get-go. So, in the absence of a politically diverse faculty, you're going to get a reduction, no one knows how much, of that intense skeptical vetting of left-affirming claims. And you're going to have people seeking to choose topics that are in political topics, if they study political or politicized topics, that will be informed by their left-affirming values. You know, and that's fine, except when everybody is left or far left, it creates huge blind spots. And so the literature, the social science, you know, the scientific literature on these topics risks, and I think often does, become disconnected from the underlying realities.
So, and I want to get to some specific examples in a moment of microaggressions, implicit bias, racial inequality, some things you've highlighted in your work about, you know, ways in which researchers have, I think, gotten more ideological and then less tied to the empirical research. But just because you brought it up, I want to ask you this question. So in terms of how you might address this problem, I mean, you've said you think that it's becoming more of a problem. Is it more intellectual diversity? And if so, how might you go about achieving that on a college campus?
What is the solution to it?
Do you see increasing intellectual diversity as a solution to it? And if so, how might you achieve that?
Yes, it would be a solution, but if it was implementable, but I don't see it being implemented from within the university anytime soon. So I don't really see it. So the most recent attempts, so let me describe two attempts to do that, which can inform why I'm pessimistic about this happening anytime soon. One was Florida Governor DeSantis's takeover of, I forget what the name of that small college is.
And so the New College or something like that?
Yeah, something. There's some small college in Florida that had a long history of sort of a progressive approach to education. And he installed a slew of sort of conservative intellectuals as the and activists as the on like the board of governors or the equivalent thereof for that school, who are tasked with remaking that school. And you know, DeSantis, as you know, I'm sure, the left hates DeSantis, so they're going to jump on pretty much anything DeSantis does. And some of the stuff he has done is clear overreach. So, you know, in the sort of media named Stop Woke Act and the sort of bevy of legislation that he's passed, he's included banning certain ideas, even in higher education. And the state can't be in its business of banning ideas. And this, as far as I can tell, I mean, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I'm pretty sure that violates the First Amendment. So at some point, someone will bring suit and Florida will lose. But taking over, appointing, you know, the administrative oversight of college, you know, state, Florida state universities and colleges, that is well within the legitimate authority of the governor. So at least legally, he has every right to appoint whoever the hell he damn well pleases as board of governors. That's a political issue. People have every right to object to it also. But the way you resolve a political problem is at the voting booth. So if people in Florida think DeSantis is doing a bad job with the way he's overhauling colleges and universities or beginning with the one, then they should just vote him out of office and vote somebody else who won't do that or do something different. But it's not an illegitimate exercise of political power. So that's one way. And that's, you know, their task is to sort of take the teeth out of the sort of progressive slant that they believe is going on at that college. And I think this is sort of like a trial run where they're going to see how this goes. And then if they pull this off to their satisfaction, they'll probably expand it outwards. That would be my guess. I have no inside into the workings of the DeSantis administration, but that would be my guess. Blunt exercises of political power presumably primarily by Republicans, although it wouldn't necessarily have to be Republicans. I just don't see Democrats doing anything like this. You would have an imposition of new policies and standards that would be intended to both block and reverse this far left trend at universities. So that would be, but this is from outside the university, not from within. The other type of thing that is in the process of being done is the University of Austin. So the University of Austin is a private, a new private college. One of the founders was Barry Weiss, you know, the former New York Times opinion writer who, you know, as she describes it, was driven out by the, you know, sort of progressive activists at the New York Times. At least at minimum, she says, she felt that there was a hostile environment for people like her, and so she left. And one of the things she has done after she left is help found this new college. And, you know, so for example, over the summer at the University of Austin, they have a whole genre of what they call forbidden courses, where, and I'm actually going to be talking at one of, as a guest speaker at one of those. So this is, but within the academy, it, you know, which is where whatever 99.999999999999% of colleges and universities are, there's no pressure to do this whatsoever. All the pressure is in the other direction. I mean, once you have enough people who, you know, just think basically that some version of progressive values are the right ones, and, you know, people who don't subscribe to them are either stupid or immoral, why would you hire stupid and immoral faculty? No one would do that. So you know, if you're not going to hire stupid and immoral faculty, then, and again, it doesn't need to be most. the way university hiring works is, it may even be, you know, I'm not saying this is true either, but even if 60 or 70% of a department or a university thinks the way I think, if a third don't, that's enough to block any hire. So, you know, typically hires are by consensus. They're often by unanimous votes. And if, you know, 10 out of 30 people in a department, you know, stand up and say, there's no way on God's earth we should hire that person is probably not going to get hired. So, again, it doesn't have to be a majority. I'm not even saying it is a majority, but the numbers are so high of left and far left activists within academia now that there is just no, I see no mechanism for increasing the sort of viewpoint, political, intellectual diversity in universities from within. So I just don't see that happening anytime soon. I have an essay from a few months ago titled, "It's going to get worse before it gets worse," because that's exactly how I see it's happening. So.
Well, and, you know, I worry about this stuff for a whole host of reasons, but the two crucial ways in which it bothers me is, number one, I believe that it's having an incredibly distorting impact on knowledge production, number one. And number two, I believe that it's only making us less likely to approach each other on the political divide if one side is also ignoring reality and the other side identifies it. So let's talk about a few that you've written about, that you've written some, I think, really insightful critiques of. So let's start with microaggressions. So this has been a very widespread topic of inquiry, and it's getting a lot of attention. There are whole, you know, programs and centers around the country that are looking at this kind of stuff. And you identify that there are some problems. So first of all, before we get to the problems, tell our viewers, what exactly is a microaggression?
Well, a microaggression is a subtle slight or insult, typically based on, the original is based on race or ethnicity, but it really could be based on any category, sex, gender identity, or really anything. So, you know, there are a slew of these microaggression scales. You know, a classic one is you seem smart for, and you can fill in whatever people want, right? So, you know, right, and you're sort of calling some, in this example of the microaggression, it's a weird compliment where you're acknowledging the intelligence of the person at the same time denigrating their entire group.
Right. If you were to tell a woman, you know, wow, I'm so shocked that you speak so well, you know, for a woman, God, you know, right, something like that.
Right.
So that's what a microaggression is. And, you know, I think, you know, me personally, I believe they exist. I believe they're a real thing. I believe that it's a plausible concept. My problem is not with that. My problem is that I don't think we've operationalized it fully as a discipline, number one. Number two, I think we've identified a whole host of statements as microaggressions that are highly questionable. I'm not sure we've demonstrated the harm in all of this. I'm not sure we've demonstrated the frequency. So let's go through a little bit of this. You say that for this to be a microaggression, it's got to be motivated by, express, and reinforce racism. So there's the very obvious ones, right? Like if I keep walking up to the same student over and over and over again and say, "Where are you from?" Okay, I think that's very clear that there's some ill intent there, right? But then there are others, and I'd like to sort of go through this three-step process here: motivated by, express, and reinforce racism. So one of the ones in that Darryl Wing Sue article, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, was something to the effect of, "I believe the most qualified person should get the job," something like that, right? That was one of them, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with you know, being motivated by bigotry, being motivated by prejudice. I mean, there is a way to say that without being motivated by prejudice, correct?
Well, it goes both ways. I mean, in the sense that, I mean, it could be an expression of prejudice as well, right? I mean, if it's used as a blanket dismissal of the without vetting and evaluating the qualifications of somebody from some oppressed group, identity group background, well, then it's probably a racist, underhanded, you know, way to undermine that person and maybe the chances of getting hired. So it's completely possible that, you know, I believe the best person should get the job, implying that you're not the best person, absolutely could be a racist microaggression. But going from it could be to therefore any statement to the effect of, I believe in merit-based hiring is therefore a microaggression, is an excessive sort of mutant version of concept creep. Right. It's one thing to say it can, and it's quite another to say it pretty much always is. And anyone who says that is a racist. And there is a lot of that rhetoric within academia now. I mean, you're on thin ice if you make a blunt defense of merit within academia.
Right. And so that's one of the biggest problems that I have with this research is, again, not the idea that there are statements that are clearly correlated with and associated with bias. It's that I don't know where the receipts are for this stuff, right? So like with this statement here, I firmly believe that there are people who could honestly in good faith make this statement. And I would like to see the receipts. I'd like to see the proof of that. No, absolutely not. Yeah. If you make this statement, you are clearly motivated by prejudice. I've not seen that it exists.
Well,
and if it doesn't exist,
if you ask for the evidence, it proves you're a racist, right? That's what I'm asking for the evidence is a microaggression. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's like a self-contained ideological, you know, capsule that outsiders can look at and say, this is completely ridiculous, but it's completely impossible to break from the inside.
That's probably one of the most disappointing things that I've seen in all of this. Is not the fact that I think social science make mistakes. That's to be expected. I mean, not as many as we make, but you know, but that's to be expected. But you know, you correct them and you move on. But it's that the response to even good faith critiques, it's using this basically the same faulty reasoning that people are critiquing to then shut down any possibility for dialogue. Right.
So as we're talking. So yeah, I mean, that's all completely true. Yes, and yes. But I opened up one of the most influential quantitative papers on microaggressions. So they do the whole thing. They have preliminary studies, and they have lots of items, and they hone to the best items, and they do factor analysis, and they do goodness of fit, very sophisticated statistics, which is why this is like one of the sort of darlings of the microaggression era. So but here are some of the items. There's like, I don't know, 40 items, so I'm not going to do 40, but someone assumed that I would have a lower education because of my race. Now, that could be true. It could be, but that requires mind reading. Now, it could have read, someone said, I have a low. Well, then it's not mind reading.
That's just overt racism.
Right. So now how do they know what a person assumed? How do they get, now maybe there's some way for them to get that sometimes, but it requires mind reading. And people are not capable of mind reading. They may be right sometimes, but there's no reason to think people are. And it's, the first 7 of the first 8 questions out of these are someone assumed questions. It's like, what the hell? What does this mean? There's a great old study. It's a small scale study, as were many studies back in those days. So, it should be taken with sort of heaping grains of salt until it's been replicated, which I don't think it has, it was a study of how people interpret others' responses to them when they think they themselves are stigmatized. And the method was a thing of beauty. So people were brought to the lab. They were told that this is what the study was about. And so that in order to have the experience of being stigmatized, they were going to have a professional makeup artist draw a horrendous scar on their face. And they did. They had a professional makeup person draw a very realistic, horrendous scar on their face. They showed them the picture of what they looked like. It did not look like makeup. It looked like this person had this disfiguring facial scar. And they were done. And then they were getting ready to be to basically have an interaction with a second person who didn't know that the scar was just drawn on. And at the last minute, the makeup artist comes back in. I just need to touch it up for a second. So the makeup artist comes in and erases the makeup. So what you have are people, there were two conditions. People who didn't think they had a scar, that was one condition. And in the condition I just described, people who did not have a scar, but thought they did. They then have the actual interaction, and the people who either did or did not have a scar painted on their faces had to rate, how their interaction partner thought of and treated them. And across the board, people perceived their partner as more hostile and demeaning to them when they thought but did not actually have a scar painted on their face than when they didn't think they had a scar in the first place. And so, what is this? This is the subjective perceptions of thinking you're stigmatized are coloring your perceptions. Now, this doesn't dismiss racism. This doesn't mean racism isn't real and sexism isn't real and it's all in the target's imaginations. No, this doesn't show anything like that. But it does show that if you believe you're stigmatized, it can alter and bias your interpretations of an interaction.
When you mentioned in your critiques of microaggressions, both in your sort of popular writings, but also in your academic research, you mentioned that even some of the best studies suggest this stuff isn't really all that frequent. And so my question to you is, so you mentioned one of the best studies, and I like that. You don't create straw men. You say, here's the best studies, that this side holds it up as the best study. And you say that, in the best studies, a majority of minorities say that they've experienced either no microaggressions in the last 6 months or between 1 and 3. So my question to you, Lee, is if that's true, and again, you say there's all sorts of reasons to believe that we shouldn't even believe this study, but if that's their best study, okay. And again, it could be wrong that they're underestimating, right? We don't know because it's not valid, right? But let's just assume that it is. Okay. So if that's the case, Lee, as a psychologist, wouldn't it be more damaging if you're a hammer looking for a nail? Everything looks like a nail, right? Like, wouldn't it be more damaging to be looking for it in every interaction than to get it once in 6 months?
Well, I would draw a distinction between people and researchers. Obviously, researchers are people, but by which I mean lay people and researchers, right? So I believe, in part based on the kind of results that you just described, with exceptions, that relatively few people who belong to minority groups are going around looking hypersensitized to evidence of prejudice or bigotry or discrimination on the part of the people they deal with. Some of that may be just because they're reasonable people. Some of it may be a coping mechanism. You know, it's like, if there is a fair amount, like, do I really want to deal with it? Isn't my life easier if I just pretend it's not there and go on with my life? There may be some of that involved. But I do think, but no matter how you get there, I do think there is far less sensitivity or even hypersensitivity on the part of lay people to these things than there are on the part of social scientists.
I just wonder, I guess I didn't articulate my point well enough, but I just wonder that, if sensitizing the public to microaggressions, which may or may not exist or may or may not exist in the way that we're characterizing them, if sensitizing them could do more damage.
Oh, well,
you see what I'm saying?
Well, so I'm sure you're actually absolutely right. The best evidence for that is actually college campuses, where, you know, tons of college campuses sort of introduce students to the college with a microaggression training, and their intentions are, I don't know, I guess if from their standpoint, their intentions are benevolent in the sense that, you know, the administrators who are endorsing and promoting and instituting these programs believe that this is a serious problem. And so we want to make students aware of their potential for engaging in these, you know, in their view, sort of toxic behaviors. And by sensitizing and increasing awareness, they're hoping to reduce the awareness and create a more welcoming, inclusive climate on the university. That's what they think they're doing. The problem is the evidence seems to be that what they're actually doing is hypersensitizing students to be alert to being derogated, you know, in subtle, you know, sort of secret, underhanded ways all the time. And so you have students on edge, and there's lots of evidence for this. Whether the evidence for growing self-censorship, college students are more and more afraid pretty much every year to say what they think about all sorts of controversial issues. You have higher levels of anxiety among teenagers and college students than there ever were. It's not only because of microaggression. It's not even primarily because of microaggression trainings, but this hypersensitivity about, if you say or do the wrong thing in the wrong context, which could include committing a microaggression, you're at risk of being publicly shamed and ostracized. Yes, I think that is part of what puts young people on edge in a way that they've never been on edge before. So, I think there is good evidence that sort of hypersensitizing the public to these sorts of issues has had a far larger downside than it has upside.
All right. So we've gone through some issues here. So we'll move on to another one in a moment. But we've mentioned these haven't been operationalized sufficiently. They are not interpreted negatively by most or all minority group members. It's not clear that there are prejudicial or implicitly aggressive motives, and it can't be validly assessed using only respondents' subjective reports. So all of that is huge, huge red flags. But the one that I think probably raises the biggest red flag for me the most is I'm not sure we've demonstrated the consequences of this. Have there been a good study that show, oh, and by the way, we should be concerned about all this because here is a demonstrable negative mental health impact, or is there good empirical research to suggest this stuff really matters?
So there's been a ton of stuff on microaggressions, and I can't say I know it all, or even most of it. So, you know, who knows what's out there? My first answer is, I don't know. I have no idea what's out there. The stuff I've seen, often there's some stuff that will correlate people's descriptions or self-reports of their experiences with things that are sometimes labeled, and in my opinion, sometimes mislabeled, microaggressions, and mental health, and maybe even some health outcomes. I'd have to double check on the health outcomes. And you get correlations there. So the more people say they have experienced these kind of subtle insults, you know, I'm inventing this, but there's some mental health impact. You know, they're more anxious or more depressed or whatever. And they may not even be anxious or depressed, but they're more anxious and more depressed than people who say they've been subject to these things to a lesser degree. The problem with this, there's no independent evidence of having actually been subject to this level of microaggressions. It's people's perceptions. And once you're dealing in the realm of perceptions, it's impossible to know whether someone's dysphoria, whether it's anxiety, depression, or anything else, is causing their perception of being mistreated, or that they're actually being mistreated and that's causing their depression or anxiety or whatever else. There's no way to know. And I suspect that a lot of it is going in the opposite direction, that the more dysphoric you are in the first place, the more likely you are to see your other people as treating you badly.
Interesting. So another question I want to ask you, because you've written also critically about this issue. So it seems like a very faulty house, but also built on a faulty foundation of implicit bias. So, you know, at least if there was a strong foundation, we could fix the house and things would be okay. But you've described that the underlying foundation of this, which is that there's implicit bias driving all this stuff, is also problematic. So tell us, what is implicit bias and what are the weaknesses in that research?
Okay. No one knows what implicit bias is. Does. I mean, everyone thinks they do, but no one knows what it is. And the reason I'm going to operationally define knows as there is a clear, widely accepted scientific definition of implicit bias. Now, in the absence of that, there could be religious definitions, I guess. There could be philosophical definitions. That's fine. But in the absence of a consensual scientific definition, then there is no thing that can be defined. It's like people are saying all sorts of different things about what it is. In fact, we have this paper coming out soon that's a review of these sorts of issues. And if you walk through 10 papers, 5 will have no definition whatsoever. That is, implicitly, they act as if implicit bias is whatever it is being measured by their measure, which is most typically the implicit association test. So they don't even have to define it because it's like whatever the implicit association test says, that's implicit bias. The other 5 will have, 4 of the 5 will have different definitions than each other. One will be about cultural, you know, beliefs. Another will be about unconscious racism. Yet another would be involve automaticity in some way. And these things are not all the same. So, there's just no definite. No one knows what implicit bias is. It's kind of, some weird mix of what people want it to be, seem to want it to believe, especially if you go, there's been a great walking back of many of the early claims about implicit bias within the peer-reviewed literature. If you ignore that for the moment and you go over how it's used in implicit bias trainings and in the mass media, people clearly want it to be something like unconscious racism. That's what they want it to be. Like racism that people aren't even aware that they have. That's what they want it to be. The problem, there are many problems with that, but one of the problems with it is there's nothing unconscious about it. There's a study, the study's old now, it's about 8 years old, if I remember, 8, 9 years old, so it's almost 10 years old at this point, where people were described, had the implicit association test described to them, and then were asked to predict their scores. And so they hadn't taken it yet. So they didn't know their scores. And their predictions corresponded to the tune of correlations of about 0.7 with what their actual scores were. So the idea that there's anything unconscious going on here is just that there's just no evidence for it. I mean, this sort of gets back to our opening conversation. If some typically far left activist, anti-racist social psychologist wants to believe that it's still getting at something unconscious, well, they can still concoct a story where it's not completely ridiculous that the implicit association test, the IAT, is getting at something unconscious. But there's no reason for anyone else except someone who really wants to believe it to actually believe it.
Yeah, and I had this discussion with Jacob Mackey on a previous episode, which is, him and I firmly believe that the whole point of science and of social science is for us to generate hypotheses and generate as many as we can, and then to test them And if they withstand testing and they continue to withstand testing, then we can build theory on top of all that, right? And then we can keep moving forward to things that will never be 100% true, but that we feel like, you know, there's the preponderance of the evidence that says that this is probably true, and it hasn't been disconfirmed by any number of studies. And so my prop is not that people have suggested what is to me a plausible concept, both of implicit bias and of microaggressions. It's that it seems as if, you know, if there's 10 steps that you need to take to get from hypothesis to intervening in people's lives and creating policies and laws, like we have hopped over many steps. Now we have bias response teams and diversity right. trainings and all sorts of things. And people are talking about making laws and on a concept we're not even sure we've operationalized. That just seems preposterous to me.
Yeah, well, the rush to change the world by implicit bias and microaggression advocates on the basis of research that was so recent, it had not had a chance to be vetted even by this, you know, mostly left-wing community that I'm, you know, that I'm referring to, but it didn't even have much of a chance to be vetted by that community. To me, attests to the existence of activist goals driving this research and exploiting it to obtain political ends. That is, if you can get a study, you know, kind of a preliminary study on microaggressions or implicit bias that kind of, you know, it has statistics and maybe it has an experiment and it kind of is kind of conventionally credible. Now what you can do is go sing to the world about how, you know, America is filled with 80 or 90% unconscious racists, and, you know, laws need to be changed in order to address this. Policies need to be changed. Practices and institutional practices all need to be adapted in order to combat the pernicious effects of unconscious racism or unconscious sexism. Now, you know, so you can see, and that is absolutely what the IAT advocates did. You know, they had a series of initial studies in the late 90s, early 2000s. By the mid 2000s, they were writing in law journals about how the law needs to take account of implicit bias. It's only been in the last, maybe since the mid 2000s, about 2015 or so, that even this highly skewed social science community, or maybe because it's so highly skewed, it took that long, has been acknowledging in the peer-reviewed literature the many, many limitations to the existing work on using the IT and other forms of implicit bias. So now that you know, such as it's not unconscious, such as the measure shows very low stability over time. So you get some score this week and get a very different score next week. Well, if you're an unconscious racist, how exactly does that work? If this stuff is important in producing discrimination, then when you undergo a training or some experimental manipulation that successfully changes your IAT score, well, then you should show lower levels of discrimination later. Well, that doesn't happen either. So sort of calling into question the whole point of what, like, if this is unconscious racism and you're able to change it experimentally, then it should reduce discrimination. That it doesn't reduce discrimination raises the possibility that whatever is being measured by the IAT has nothing to do with discrimination.
So I see a really, again, let me be clear. There's disingenuousness on both sides. So I'm not even sure that's a correct word to use, but there's insincerity on both sides. So you mentioned, you know, DeSantis and Rufo earlier. And so, you know, while I think that there are certain things within the academy that absolutely need to be reformed, it's not going to be done by a guy that says, I want to brand everything CRT so that any discussion of race becomes right. toxic in America. So right. you're just yeah. substituting a problem with a problem.
Right.
But to be clear, so again, I recognize, let's just start this part of the conversation by saying, I recognize we are facing an army of disingenuous bad faith actors. I get that. So let's just set that aside for a moment. But I see so many bad faith arguments on our side, on the side of academics. So one of the things that I see constantly is, you guys keep talking about critical race theory and yet it's not anywhere. Well, yeah, it, just because it's not called that, right? So like microaggressions, implicit bias, that's critical race theory and it's everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. I mean, you know, in fairness to some of that argument, I don't know. I don't think that the empirical work on implicit bias and probably not microaggressions either emerged from critical race theory. I think they emerged independently. Now, there's a set of underlying assumptions that they all might share. You know, the sort of the starting point for a lot of the work on implicit bias and possibly on microaggressions as well is that, you know, the laws protecting discrimination were abolished in the 60s. The passage of civil rights laws, you know, overturned Jim Crow and gave legal protections to anybody, regardless of race, creed, religion, or ethnicity, or anything like that. Okay. So despite the fact that people were granted and now guaranteed by the federal government equality before the law, you know, that'd be the 1960s. Flash forward to like the 80s and 90s, 25 years later, say, inequality was about the same as it was in the 60s. And maybe it had improved a little, but it hadn't improved very much. And maybe it hadn't improved at all. I mean, I'd have to go back to the census data. But it certainly hadn't improved much. So independent, putting critical race theory aside, social scientists reasonably, I think, asked themselves and asked each other, well, if it's not the law that's creating inequality, what is? You know, so then they said, well, maybe it's just prejudice. But if you looked at surveys, national surveys, representative sample surveys over the decades, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, people were expressing less blatant prejudice and racism every decade. You know, so, you know, one of the questions is, you know, some version of how upset would you be if your child married someone of another race? And the number of people saying they'd be upset by that went steadily down to, you know, low double digits by the 80s, I think. And so there wasn't a whole lot of evidence for classic explicit expressions of prejudice. And yet inequality persisted. So they're like, well, maybe it's really subtle. Maybe it's maybe people know not to say the wrong things anymore, but they really in their heart of hearts harbor the same hostilities, the same, you know, derogatory, bigoted beliefs and attitudes that they ever held, and they're just buried deep. You know, they're either, they know it and they're not willing to say it, or maybe they don't even, that's so deep they don't even know they have it. In 1989, that was not a ridiculous line of thinking. In 2023, after over 30 years of such research, basically consistently failing to deliver on its promise of explaining discrimination and inequality, I think now there's no reason to believe any of this. I mean, it was not a bad try, and it didn't really emerge from critical race theory.
Sure, but a lot of the most prominent critical race theorists today argue that all this stuff is just sort of baked into all of our interactions, right? All of our policies, right?
Yes, yes. It is the other way around. I think the critical race theorists, people like Robin DiAngelo and Ibram Kendi, would exploit the existence of research on implicit bias and microaggressions and stereotype threat and a whole slew of other things uncritically, because it helped make their sort of ideologically driven points. Yes, that I think is true.
Let's do some lightning round. You ready?
Okay, go.
So I'll give you some lightning round questions. You can go as fast as you want. So your response to it's a good or a bad idea to implement DEI diversity statements in hiring?
Bad.
Why would you say that in a sentence or less?
They function as ideological litmus tests, and that's the last thing universities need.
Diversity training in the workplace, does it work?
No. No, there's good evidence that has, I'm saying no, not just because there's no evidence that it does work and I don't like it. There's good evidence that it doesn't accomplish anything at all, including increasing diversity. There are ways to increase diversity. Whether an organization should be in the business of increasing diversity is an interesting question in its own right. And that's not what you asked, but there is good evidence on the effectiveness of diversity trainings for increasing diversity, and they don't work, and they have unintended negative side effects. So it's just it's a loss all around. Diversity trainings are a good lose-lose situation.
In a sentence or less, tell us, what is intellectual imperialism?
It is the arrogant presumption that one's view, perspective, or in the social sciences theory or finding is correct, and that anyone who says otherwise really doesn't deserve the same place in the discourse or in the literature.
To any of our academic friends or folks on the left, which are often the same thing, who says anybody who's worried about cancel culture is just worried about not being able to be a bigot publicly anymore, what would your response be to that?
Probably my best response to this is that there are a number of legitimate and controversial topics in the public domain, like how much affirmative action should we have? And what should affirmative action be? Because it could be anything from mentoring and outreach to preferential selection. And it is vividly clear that almost every time people, because there have been a number of state referendums, have had the opportunity to vote for or against affirmative action, they vote against it, including most recently in California, which is one of the most far left states in the country and is majority minority. That is, there's no racial ethnic majority there. And it's still voted to ban affirmative action in hiring. So, absolutely. If you oppose affirmative action in academia, you'll probably be denounced as a racist. But these are absolutely legitimate political topics that should be able to be discussed, especially in academia.
All right, two last questions. The last one you can go longer on if you want. But I lost it. What was the the replication crisis in psychology still a problem, or have you solved the issue?
In between, I think things have gotten better than they were when it first broke, but it's definitely not solved. And with the replication crisis, it became more acceptable to criticize, sort of exposed to open air, reveal all sorts of other problems, problems with measurement, problem with statistics, problem with theory. And as a replication crisis reverberated, these other problems became exposed as well. And people are earnestly grappling with improving them with some success, probably less success than the science reformers would have hoped, but more than there was in 2011 when the stuff first broke.
One of the things I really liked is now I kind of see it like if you deny somebody's request to see your data, you know, if you're not transparent, it's almost assumed at this point you've done something wrong, right? And yeah. I think that's actually been a positive change.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So last question. So if Lee Jessam was put in charge, let's not say Rutgers because we don't want to get you in trouble. So a fictional university that's got, you know, like sociology, I think I saw Jonathan Haidt said something like 40-1 liberals to conservatives. So you're put in charge of a university and you see a problem of intellectual monoculture and, poor standards of evidence for truth claims and ideology in the classroom. What's one of the big one or two or three things you might try to do to try to bring some more intellectual diversity back to your institution?
So let me tell you the closest I have come to that. And that is, in my lab, you know, I intermittently admit graduate students. I mean, they're a big investment in time and effort. And so I don't admit them every year. It's really every few years I'll admit one or two or something like that. And I only half jokingly like to describe my experience as cornering the market on really good conservative social science students. So it's not that hard to corner the market because there aren't that many. I mean, the reason there are so few faculty is because there aren't that many graduate students along those lines. And I do this very, I have a very conventional diversity statement up on my sort of faculty webpage at Rutgers that refers to all the classic identity groups that a far left progressive would want me to. I don't know that they would like my statement per se, but it certainly welcomes such people and, you know, try to make it a supportive environment in my lab and all that sort of stuff. But in addition to that, I actually refer to conservatives and religious people in the same breath. So students who are conservative or religious, or in one case, both, fairly recently, actually maybe in a couple of cases, they look at this and it's like, to them, it's a breath of fresh air. It tells them, I will be welcome there. Probably. I mean, they should interview and check me out and check out my students, and they'll find out that's mostly true. So hopefully completely true, but at least mostly true. And so this, it's just not that hard. It's just not that hard. You asked about a university. One, all you have to do with the diversity initiative is include these other identity groups as part of the diversity initiative. So that would be a big help. The other thing, if I was head of a university, you could create centers or institutes around topics likely to attract people who are not exclusively interested in things from a far left perspective. So you might have a center for free speech and academic freedom. You might have a center for skepticism in social science and philosophy of science, right? If you get people skeptical or sort of experienced in the ways of being a rigorous skeptic, I'm less worried about their politics already. It's like I can have a conversation with that person. So you could create nodes that would attract people that are not restricted the typical sort of far left progressive academic that is now that universities are now a magnet for. So those would be the two things. You say so bluntly that that's part of what your diversity efforts are, and you create these nodes to attract people outside of far left progressive circles.
Lee Jussum, I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours, and we did talk for hours and hours trying to get our technology set up earlier. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. This is great.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you. Till we meet again. Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you. Till we meet again.
Goodbye, good luck, and may the good Lord take a liking to you.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.